So, Tom, where do you want to start this story?
I think we should start in August of 2018 on the other side of the world. I'm in Vietnam reporting on an assignment with our crew, and the subject of the assignment is a remarkable man in his early 70s who still looks vital and strong enough to pick up a washtub full of bricks and throw it over a fence. His name is Rocky Blyer, a halfback for the Pittsburgh Steelers during their dynasty in the 1970s. And he and I are standing in a field in the Hep Duc Valley in Vietnam. The temperatures are approaching 100 and the humidity is the same, where it is sweltering and smothering. And there's a clearing essentially in the jungle off a dirt road.
We're coming out of this wood line after we've taken that break, but
we're at this exact geographical point because of what it conjures and what it represents.
Coming back to this area and what took place, trying to visualize what it was back then as it is now, trying to get a sense of where we were.
The place where an ambush from the Vietnam War happened, an ambush that Rocky Blyer was caught in the center of. This one firefight would change the course of his life and in many ways, the meaning of his life as a man, as a football player, as a veteran. And as he and I are walking around this field, he's taking it all in and he's overcome by his emotions.
Think about those guys that got killed.
And a short time later, he collapses.
Rock,
okay.
I'm gonna let you stay down there for a little bit, but I want this on your head, okay?
All right.
John, keep that there.
I got it.
And as I'm looking down at Rocky Blyer, I realize this is a trip in an attempt to reconcile Rocky with his past that takes us on a path none of us could have ever imagined.
For generations, countless men and women from around the sports world have served our country's military, but none have a story quite like Rocky Blyer's. Today, in honor of Veterans Day, Tom Rinaldi recounts Blyer's incredible football comeback in the wake of a devastating combat injury, and how his eventual return to Vietnam helped heal wounds he didn't know were there. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Wednesday, November 11th. This is ESPN Daily. Tom, as we speak right now, the Pittsburgh Steelers might be the best team in football. They are 8-0. Their history is even more self-evident. It's the six Super Bowls, it's the big names, it's Terry Bradshaw, Mean Joe Green, all of that. But we're here today to talk about Rocky Blyer, a halfback for them during their 1970s dynasty.
By the way, Pablo, no one would give Rocky a harder time than Terry Bradshaw and Mean Joe Green and his teammates that he was somehow collected, somehow in the same sentence with them. So we can start there.
I want to rewind with you here at the beginning because I need people to appreciate where Rocky Blyer came from. So coming out of college, Tom, what kind of a football player was this guy?
Well, he was the absolute classic, undersized, but very determined and very strong, perhaps slow of foot football player. He wouldn't love that description, but he's heard it often from much more informed voices than my own, like many of his teammates. He went to Notre Dame, won a national championship there as a junior in 1966, was voted a team captain his senior year in 67. Pablo, was not on anybody's draft radar very high up. He got drafted by the Pittsburgh Steelers in 68 in, you ready? the 16th round, 417th overall. There were 17 rounds back then.
I was the 417th person picked in the draft that year. I was not the last guy picked, okay? So, you know, I might have some chance to be able to make the team at the time.
So if he's not really this standout prospect and he's basically just trying to make the team, what happens next in his story?
He finds out that he's been drafted by the Pittsburgh Steelers. And he understands it's going to be a challenge to make the roster. That's going to be the first mission of achievement for him. And he does. He begins his rookie season. He doesn't get necessarily a lot of playing time, some, but he makes the team. He's going through that rookie year. And then
one of the equipment guys holler, "Hey, Rock, there's a letter over here for you." So I jump up and I go over and I get it very tenderly and I pick it up and I open it up and it said, "Greetings. We'd like to inform you that you've been inducted into the armed services of your country." It was my draft notification. I mean, it was like, holy crap.
At that time, Pablo, very few players were getting drafted. There were a handful. But most found accommodation through their franchises and the connections those franchises had to avoid direct conscription and enlistment through the draft into military service in wartime. That did not happen for Blyer.
And I want to give some other important context here because this is 1968 when he gets the letter that you mentioned. The U.S. military is in the depths of the Vietnam War.
The lull ended with a vengeance. Among the 149 places shelled was the U.S. Navy hospital at Da Nang. The outbreak in fighting should make it clear to all concerned that there is still a very active and nasty war going on here in Vietnam.
While he was shocked and stunned, he never really entertained not going. And when we asked him about that, his answer was, in a way, stunningly simple. You get drafted, you go.
It wasn't part of my roots to be a conscientious objector. About what? There was a responsibility. I felt, okay, you get drafted. You do not not go. You get drafted, you go.
So when he gets to Vietnam, when he arrives there, what's his experience like?
The initial experience for him was pretty shocking. He refers Pablo to seeing the men who are getting ready to complete their tours.
It was these guys with like a 1,000-yard stare, you know, that were unshaven, dirty, sweaty, coming up, weapon over their shoulder, tired. Now, they could have been 19, 20, 21 years old, but in my mind, they looked like they were 30s or 40s.
The courage, the fear, the exhaustion, the loss, the uncertainty, felt like he could see all those emotions immediately written large across the faces, plainly visible, of the first sets of soldiers that he saw.
Did his fellow soldiers in Vietnam even know who Rocky Blyer was?
Look, to be clear, this wasn't everybody's All-American, everybody's All-Pro, the surefire Hall of Famer showing up by any means. Yet, there absolutely were NFL fans and football fans who knew who Rocky Blyer was. So I think he was seen as a bit of a curiosity, but he very, very quickly ingratiated himself with his fellow soldiers as a guy who was just like them. Here to do the best he could for the guy on his left, the guy on his right, and survive.
And at what point, Tom, does he find himself in the thick of battle in Vietnam? At what point does he get into these situations that give rise to the faces and the feelings that you just described?
So Rocky arrives in the springtime. Ultimately, his platoon will make its way into the Hepduck Valley in the summer. It's already been an absolutely terrible summer.
44 South Vietnamese soldiers died here at Sidewinder when the base was overrun in the early hours of the morning, August 12th. was the end of the 1969 midsummer lull, and not unexpected.
It's been filled with contact between the two sides, and there have been many American casualties, as well as casualties on the North Vietnamese side. And on August 20th, Blyer's platoon receives their orders that they are on a mission to recover the fallen soldiers who have been killed in the previous day's ambush. Now it's up to Blyer's platoon to essentially recover those fallen brothers. There's great tension in the platoon. There's almost an expectation that they're going to come into contact. They're doing everything they can to be as quiet as they can, but they know they're in a vulnerable spot. And that turns out absolutely to ignite in a sudden firefight and ambush.
All of a sudden, a machine gun starts shooting.
This rice paddy is being lit up with contact from both sides. Blyer got down as quickly as he could.
Boom. Everybody hits the deck. I felt a thud in my left leg. I got hit.
And in that moment, he thinks to himself, Lord, if you get me out of this, I promise you, I will do everything I can to maximize the life that you've given me to live. I'll do everything I can to honor the fact that you allowed me to survive this. He then crawls 200 yards through the rice paddy while still bleeding under heavy attack, his platoon returning fire. They are outnumbered by more than 100 North Vietnamese at the time. He makes it back to where his commanding officer is.
Next, somebody hollers, grenade. And then I see another grenade come flying through the air. And so I jump out of the way. I mean, I jump in the opposite direction, but as I jump, it goes off. Blows me up.
Shrapnel shoots directly up his right foot and almost entirely up his right leg. He had to be taken at nightfall, carried by a series of soldiers through the darkened jungle. 9 hours in a poncho, being carried less than 2 miles to a medevac zone. He's dropped repeatedly as the other soldiers grow exhausted. They then switch out. Other soldiers come to continue to carry him. He ultimately makes it to the medevac zone, and from there he's airlifted and he ultimately ends up in a Tokyo hospital.
What was the extent of Blyer's injuries as a result of that ambush?
Nerve damage in both legs, broken bones, a staph infection, which is rapidly becoming very serious from his open wounds to the point that it could threaten his life, and an open question. Will doctors be able to save his legs? And if so, what kind of mobility will he have?
And at this point, what does he know about his football career?
John Fish, our producer, did an incredible job and actually tracked down in Thailand the doctor who treated Rocky Blyer in the Tokyo hospital for the Army, Dr. Lauer, who reprised essentially what he told Rocky. We're going to be able to save your legs. It's going to be a fight to walk again. Your football career is over. He told him that definitively. You'll never play football again.
after the break, Rocky Blyer plots a return to football and eventually a return to Vietnam.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
So, Tom, Rocky Blyer is now recovering from those injuries that you described. And at what point does he actually start to consider the possibility that he could return to football one day?
From the moment he got to the Tokyo hospital.
He just said, don't expect to get back. My first thought, no, I got a foot. I got a leg. I got two arms.
He never accepted what Dr. Lohr told him. He understood that's one medical opinion. But he doesn't know football, my desire to play it. He doesn't know. And then he gets a postcard.
I got a postcard in the mail. And the postcard had two lines on it, very simple. It said, Rock, team's not doing well. We need you. Art Rooney, owner of the club. And that was it.
It's sent by Art Rooney, known as the chief, the owner of the Steelers. And what that did for his spirits in Rocky's description was immediately connect him to the notion of possibility with the Steelers. Whether that was Rooney's intent, I think, is open to interpretation. Ultimately, by the spring of 1970, he's just a few months removed now from that rice paddy, in essence, half a year, if you will. He's in the Steelers camp, and he's going to try to give it a go.
What does he even look like, given this timeline in those first few weeks back in camp?
He's still got a clear, pronounced limp. He's not even walking without a limp. Most people don't think he has any chance to make it. And in an act of mercy, the Steelers put him on the practice squad. Just sort of, here you go. You're with us. You're on the practice squad.
Nobody said no. Nobody said, no, you're not good enough to make the team. I mean, you're not good enough. For whatever reason, they wanted to keep me around, whether they felt guilty, whether they felt to give him a shot.
But Blyer becomes an unbelievably dedicated workout weight room presence. At a time, Pablo, when not everybody hit weights, he became a smaller Adonis. His thighs became huge. His ability to bench, to squat, to fly. He was just an unbelievably strong guy, lifting 6 days a week. He works his way up the roster and incredibly into the starting backfield. They're not a great team, but he climbs and climbs against all odds and every ounce of probability. Rock, you're a starter. You're gonna be with this other guy. His name is Franco Harris.
This autumn, at age 28, after 5 years of patient waiting and determined work, Rocky Blyer scored his first professional touchdown.
But I mean, it really makes me feel good, but what it really tells me is that people really don't know the capacity of a human being.
Wait a minute. Hold on here. So Rocky Blyer, at age 28, becomes a starter not very far removed from a life-threatening series of injuries in the Vietnam War. I mean, just straight up, Tom, how is this even possible? How does this guy do that?
So if you ask Franco Harris, his quick answer will be, well, it's because of me. That's why. Look, it was pretty clear. Rock, you block. Me, I run.
Rocky Blyer, the running back. 6-0.
It worked magically. It was the absolute definition of thunder and lightning. Blyer sold out block after block, tore hole after hole open, blew defender after defender up. And the guy behind him, a huge specimen himself, Franco Harris, then begins to roll. And now the Steelers begin to find an identity. And then they have a quarterback, Terry Bradshaw. And it all begins to fit together.
The Steelers' offense is balanced with quarterback Terry Bradshaw enjoying newfound confidence and running back Franco Harris and Rocky Blyer grinding out the yards on the ground.
So how would you describe the career that Rocky Blyer went on to have? Because he becomes more than just the accessory to Franco Harris, right?
He does. Incredibly, he then begins to show, hey, I have a little speed. Okay, I might not be the fastest guy, but I'm not the slowest guy either. He becomes a 1,000-yard rusher in his own right. As a blocker, as a runner, as a route runner, and a pass catcher, he just continues to add value, ways that he can contribute to a game plan. And he becomes integral to the 4 Super Bowl titles in 74, 75, and 78, 79.
Bradshaw, number 12 at quarterback. Rocky Blyer, number 20.
His greatest moment in the 78 Super Bowl. Super Bowl 13.
Bradshaw rolling to the right, throws on the move into the end zone, and it is caught for a touchdown to Rocky Blyer.
And I threw my hands up, and the ball stuck. I came down across the goal line for a score and a touchdown.
And the Rock went up and snagged it for the TD.
He'll tell you he climbed the ladder 21 feet high to make the catch, the go-ahead touchdown catch in the end zone. Terry Bradshaw will say, it was the only place he could have possibly put the ball, and he was shocked that Blyer actually caught it.
It made the cover of Sports Illustrated, which was even more terrific.
Rocky stood out as that guy that a lot of folks in Pittsburgh, which at the time was almost entirely a steel industry town, they saw something in that grit and spirit that they could relate to, that deeply resonated with so many residents of Pittsburgh. Hey, he's a fighter. He's got grit. That was something that connected him to this day, Pablo, deeply to the folks in Pittsburgh. Realize, Pablo, this was a time when many servicemen and the servicewomen who were with them, not as large a number as they are now, returned to a country deeply divided, and a large population which did not support them at all.
You kill people! You kill people!
End the war in Vietnam! Bring the troops home!
They fought for the country in war, only to return to an anti-hero's welcome. Blyer could talk about the fact that there were folks who had spit on troops who had returned. And he would tell you, okay, so maybe we didn't need a parade, but we didn't need to become pariahs for answering the call and serving our country. Being called baby killers, village burners, that somehow being called uniformed murderers, the worst possible labels and tags that so many veterans received. And here was Blyer, who had an outlet, a way to represent veterans in a venue that draws so much attention, professional football and the NFL, who would share his story.
Coming up, Rocky Blyer returns to the field in Vietnam, where he almost lost his life a half century ago.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
So, Tom, we now turn to where you yourself enter the story, because you'd been brought into these conversations ESPN had been having with Rocky Blyer about returning to Vietnam. So how did this idea to return progress into an actual plan to go back there?
Here we go back to our wonderful friend and our fantastic producer, John Fish. He put that idea out there. Rock, do you think it's time? Rock, do you want to go back? Rock, what about it? And as we get closer and closer to 50 years, Rocky says, you know what? Yeah, I want to go back. I do.
So how would you describe what that trip ended up being like?
So we got in country, we went to Da Nang, we acclimated, and then a couple of days in, we ultimately, on August 20, 49 years later, took the drive out. We passed very small marketplaces and small villages, but ultimately, the houses and the huts became fewer and fewer. And through the GPS, got to that rice paddy. And when we did, we had explained to Rocky in advance, we're just going to let you walk around. You might walk around for 2 minutes. It may be longer than that. But when you feel ready, give us a signal, and then we'll ask you a few questions. Does that sound okay? And he said, sure, because we wanted to give him his space. We really did not know what to expect. He gets out. He begins to walk. He's wearing a mic. And at one point he says, almost under his breath,
Jesus Christ.
Jesus Christ. And we just let him have his space. The cameras were at a distance. I was not near him. But ultimately, I approached him when he had stopped.
You came out. You walked through. And you paused for a second. And quietly, you said to yourself, Jesus Christ. Why?
I don't know. You know, I suppose, you know, what took place coming back to this area. And what took place, trying to visualize what it was back then as it is now, trying to get a sense of where we were. And, you know, so you think about, those guys that got killed. And for what in the waste of life that had taken place. I guess that's, you know, when I was thinking that, you know, I'd never had the chance to come back here.
He began to tell a story that he hadn't told of a platoon mate named Hawaii.
It's from Hawaii. We called him Hawaii. Everybody had a nickname. And so I remember, you know, you get to talk to him. He was engaged to be married.
and became absolutely overcome emotionally.
Anyway, he's down. I mean, he's down, and he's not moving. He took two rounds, and he dies.
It was entirely enveloping.
Okay, I gotta...
Take a break. Take a break. John, yeah. do we have water nearby?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Relax.
Yeah, I need some.
Okay? Relax. Yeah, we're going to go and grab it.
Okay.
Take your time.
Almost 100 degrees, humidity over 90%.
Take your time.
It's late morning. He walks and sits down. He collects himself a bit.
Rock, easy. Okay, easy.
And he suddenly seems like maybe he's not feeling that well. And the next thing we know, Pablo, he just falls out. He collapses. And we're stunned.
Rock.
Okay.
I'm gonna let you stay down there for a little bit, but I want this on your head, okay?
All right.
John, keep that there.
I got it.
And I'm telling you, when he's down on the ground and there is not a medical facility anywhere nearby and you don't really know what's happening, it's a frightening moment.
Okay?
Jason there?
Yes. Stay there, Rock, till we get the van pulled around, okay?
Okay.
All right.
We get him into the van.
Ready?
I got it.
Okay.
Come on.
Okay.
Yep. We're more than an hour away from a health clinic. Thank God we get there and we find out that he's had heat stroke. His body temperature has dropped to, I believe, 92 degrees. And he just has to be pumped full of fluids. Thank God that ultimately, we were able to get him treated and well. Not even through with the last IV. When are we going back? When are we going back where, Rock? Where? When are we going back there? To the field. We head back to the hotel, on the drive to the hotel. When are we going back? Why do you want to go back, Rock? We just didn't get it finished. He's cleared medically by the doctor at the clinic, and the day after that, we go back. And he's overcome with the emotion all over again.
So everything's changed. So you look at the landscape, and it's gone. What was it all for? Just those who didn't make it. It was like, for what? You know? So, I get to come back and kind of relive this experience and put it in some perspective.
You end up running in to a person who ends up having some meaning for Rocky. What happened there?
Well, what are the odds? On the return trip, a Viet Cong soldier who had served as a scout didn't like the way his side had treated him and his family. He becomes an American scout, and he proves it to us with some of the insignia that he's able to produce. He stops to come and question what we're doing. He engages with Rocky.
Say it.
Say your name.
My name, Rocky. Your name?
My name, Rocky.
We had Rocky interview him.
It is now 50 years later. How would you describe the war?
And in Vietnamese, which we had translated, misery, just killing, father and child, endlessly cruel. Beyond that, nothing at all. Essentially, Pablo, essentially, the two men, 5 decades later, had the same answer.
So, what do you think was going on in that field for Rocky? I mean, what did that field show you about what it may have ended up meaning for him?
I think it meant so much more than he ever anticipated and ever expected. And Rocky would go on to say as much, that he didn't realize that somewhere inside him, maybe a place that he had locked away or a place he had suppressed and buried for decade after decade, that was not reconciled.
That whole emotion that came up like out of my socks, I mean, just came up over me. As I look back, and having gone all through that was maybe a catharsis I never had before.
And going back and standing on that patch of earth, that couldn't be suppressed anymore.
I don't need to go back to Vietnam again. And maybe for me, it accomplished what it needed to accomplish as a closure in that part of my life.
There's a lot of reasons why Rocky Blyer survived that day, made it out of that ambush, made it through the Tokyo hospital, back to Pittsburgh, climbed the roster, earned a spot, became a champion. But I'd like to believe, Pablo, it's because he honored that prayer. God, if somehow I survive this, I will do everything I can with the rest of my life to honor this chance. And that's what he's done.
Tom Rinaldi, I thank you for telling a Veterans Day story that we're going to remember for a long, long time.
Thank you so much, Pablo, for the opportunity to share it with you.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.